Welcome to the latest special edition in the Elemental Economics series from the BBC. I am Justin Rowlatt. And today we're exploring the role of an element we would be lost without. It helps lubricate the equipment that drills the wells that provides the world with oil and gas, but that is not the main reason why it helps us get around. That's down to its role in keeping time. In fact, you could say this element is the source of time itself, as we will be discovering on Business Daily from the BBC. Today I have come to somewhere really rather special. You could describe this as the place where time began, or at least modern time, because I'm at the National Physical Laboratory in Teddington, and this is where the most accurate clocks of their day were developed back in the 1920s. And here in the lobby of the building, they've got an example of those first quartz clocks developed by a horologist called Louis Essen, which was at that time the most accurate timepiece in the world. And it's actually a lot smaller than I expected. It's about 10 centimetres in diameter. It's round. And actually, you can see inside the ring of quartz, though quite how it works, I don't understand. But of course, new developments have superseded the quartz clock, as I'm going to discover. Well, I've come down into the heart of the building to meet Leon Lobo, and you have the most wonderful title. You are in charge of disseminating time here at the National Physical Laboratory, which is a wonderful title, and I have to ask you, what on earth does it mean, Leon?
So I work on distributing the UK's timescale to the UK.
So your job is to tell Britain the time, yeah?
That's correct.
Accurate timekeeping for the nation.
That's correct.
That's entrusted to you. How accurate were those early quartz clocks, like the Essen clock that I saw in the lobby here?
The ring resonators that Essen developed were accurate to the second in 3 years.
So it would lose a second every 3 years, which I have to say, if I had a watch that was that accurate, I would be pretty pleased.
It's not enough in this day and age, and that's why we've developed new and much more accurate ways to measure the time. And I'll be showing you one of our systems here.
So just in here, the door, I should say, is marked primary frequency standard. So let's have a look inside. Now, we have been told we have just 5 minutes in here. So what we're looking at, it looks a bit like a fridge where the door's been taken off and you can see the gubbins inside. I know that's a very unglamorous description for what I'm sure is an incredible bit of equipment. It's got a big kind of cylinder and then underneath what looks like weird aluminium bits and bobs with wires coming off it. Quite an exciting looking piece of equipment. Leon, what is it?
So this is our cesium fountain.
Cesium fountain?
That's correct.
Sounds very exotic.
That's right, it is.
So cesium is the element at the heart of this.
That's correct.
And what does a cesium fountain do?
So a cesium fountain tells us what a second is.
So this device is to kind of calibrate the second.
That's correct. We have a chamber filled with cesium atoms that we cool down and create something called optical molasses.
Optical molasses?
That's correct. Mm. With the lasers, we actually cool the cesium atoms down to near absolute zero and causing them to stop vibrating.
So like molasses,
exactly.
Sugar, it gets a bit sticky.
That's right. And essentially launch this atom ball through a microwave chamber and let it drop down under gravity.
Oh, so that's,
that's where the fountain bit comes.
Because it rises up and falls down. And all of that is happening within this chamber here.
That's correct.
Wow. But why cesium, and what are you actually looking for?
The best person to ask is just over here, Christoph Simaniak, our lead scientist on our cesium fountain development.
So you run the cesium fountain.
That's correct.
And I suppose, I've got all sorts of questions about this, but I've got to ask you, I mean, first of all, what is it about cesium?
Cesium was chosen back in the 50s when people first discovered atomic clocks using atomic transitions to provide standards for frequency measurements.
Hold on, you're going to have to help me here. When you say a transition, what do you mean?
If you think of an atom, an electron going around, what the electron motion can be going around the nucleus, it can go around in the orbital motion, or can spin around its own axis. The spin can go from one direction to another direction, and that effect, changing the spinning direction from one side to another, requires absorption or emission of a low energy radiation, microwave radiation.
So you're looking for a change in the motion of the electron when you fire this microwave radiation at it. And why does that give you a measure of time?
Because that can only happen if you fire microwaves of a very specific frequency.
So basically, the cesium atom is telling you the frequency of your microwave radiation, which is giving you the measure of time. And that's how you calibrate the second.
It tells me whether the frequency is right or wrong.
Do you know what? I think I just about understand it. But again, why cesium? Because there are lots of other atoms you could have chosen.
Back in the 50s, when people first found about the nuclear resonance, cesium has this resonance frequency the highest, at around 10 gigahertz.
So the higher the frequency, the more likely you are to get an accurate calibration.
However, you didn't want to go too high with frequency in those times because you wouldn't be able to count those high frequencies.
Because we simply didn't have
the electronics wasn't too fast at that time. So 10 gigahertz was the highest available.
So this was a kind of compromise, which of course begs the question how accurate these machines are. And I'm going to refer that back to you, Leon, because, of course, you're in charge of disseminating time. So how accurate are machines like this?
So our cesium fountain is currently accurate to a second in 158 million years.
That's the most extraordinarily accurate thing that I've ever heard of.
Absolutely. But we're also developing the next generation of clocks, which will be accurate to the second in 14 billion years.
Do you need to be that accurate?
Absolutely.
Do you need to go to 14 billion years? How old's the Earth? The Earth's only 4.5 billion years old. Why do you need to be accurate to that?
The universe is 13.8.
So you'll lose a second in the entire lifespan of the universe.
That's correct.
That's pretty accurate, Leon, isn't it?
And it's important to get that level because...
Is it?
We are developing the next generation of global navigation systems.
Yeah, but still,
the next generation of
to one second
systems.
In the entire history of the universe is still a level of accuracy that I think you'd struggle to find an application for.
Absolutely. The accuracy makes these clocks very sensitive to the gravitational potential of the Earth.
And I have to say, that makes me understand a little better the anxiety of the guy in charge of the cesium fountain. He was very, very reluctant to let us in here, and we only came in on condition that we'd talk for just 5 or 6 minutes,
Absolutely.
And then he told us he was going to unceremoniously boot us out of here. These new clocks, these super unbelievably staggeringly accurate clocks that you're talking about, are they based on cesium?
No, they're based on strontium and ytterbium at NPL.
So these are different elements.
So the optical clocks that we're developing operate at 5 orders of magnitude higher frequencies. So instead of operating in the microwave regime, they operate in the optical regime.
So that's way, way higher speed.
That's correct. Now, by being sensitive to the gravitational potential, we can now use these clocks as sensors to map the Earth's gravitational potential and understand what is beneath us, effectively, at any point on the Earth's surface.
Because you can measure the difference in measured time when moving into the realms of time-space. Is that right?
Not particularly.
Oh, okay. Don't leave this in. Right, well, now we've come to a laboratory here at the NPL. And I'm actually quite relieved to see you, Andrea. We're here with Professor Andrea Sella, who's the pacemaker of the Elemental Economics series. I'm pleased to see you because my mind is still fizzing and buzzing with the idea that you have clocks that are accurate to 1 second in 14 billion years. Putting that aside, what other applications are there for cesium?
Well, cesium actually turns up in a whole pile of different applications. Cesium is an element which closely resembles sodium, potassium in its chemistry. And as a result, you can make salts like cesium chloride and bromide and iodide. And the interesting thing about cesium iodide, for example, is that you can use it as a radiation detector. If you have a block of cesium iodide and you shine X-rays at it, in a darkened room, you will see tiny little flashes of light coming from that cesium iodide. So you take a photograph of the flashes, so it's a kind of way of indirectly visualizing either X-rays or alternatively radiation.
So how was cesium discovered then?
Cesium was the first element to be discovered by spectroscopy. In other words, by looking at the light that the atoms give out.
So kind of light and cesium, there's a big theme here.
Well, there are tremendous connections all the way through. And back in the 19th century, the chemist Robert Bunsen, the guy who invented the Bunsen burner, teamed up with a physicist whose name was Kirchhoff, and together they started to analyze the light which came out of flames using a prism. And what you observe is that only certain colors appear instead of getting the typical rainbow that you'll get from sunshine. They were able to show that the light from the sun gave evidence for the same elements that you had on Earth. Suddenly, it became clear in the 19th century that chemistry wasn't just something you had in the lab or outside the lab. You could think of it universally including the stars. Now, what we should do is to actually take a look at some of these colors.
Yeah, let's do that.
And I've got a rather primitive version of a Bunsen burner. This is actually a plumber's torch. And we'll quickly turn it on. And there we have a nice roaring flame. I'm going to take a little bit of a cesium salt, and now I'll put it in the flame and look at the color that comes out.
Oh, yeah.
It's got a bluish-violet color.
Bluish. Oh, yeah, that was beautiful. That was a kind of purpley-pinky-violet color. Yeah, a wonderful color.
And that was the light that Bunsen and Kirchhoff spotted. They'd never seen that light anywhere else. And they asked themselves, how could they isolate that element? And they actually took 30,000 liters of water from a local spa, and they boiled it down. And then systematically they removed every element they could think of until eventually they were left with a tiny smidge. And that smidge gave the blue flame. That was cesium.
And that's how it was discovered, uniquely through the properties of light.
Uniquely through the way in which these atoms interact with light. Now, the way in which the atoms interact with visible light is what we see. And in the atomic clocks, they're actually using something much, much lower in energy, down in the microwave region.
And there goes the Bunsen burner. And yeah. Mr. Bunsen's great adventure in cesium. But what else is cesium used for, and where else might you find cesium?
Well, cesium actually has quite a checkered history. Because, in fact, one of the isotopes of cesium is produced in nuclear reactors. And at the time of the Chernobyl accident, when the reactor opened and released a plume of radioactive material, cesium was actually released over Europe. And 1,500 kilometers away, the cesium, the radioactive cesium in this case, rained out of the sky and landed in little patches across the countryside, as far away as Scotland, Wales, even Ireland.
Because I remember this from when I was a kid. So when we talked about the fallout from Chernobyl, we were talking about an isotope of cesium raining down on Britain and, of course, elsewhere in Europe.
Absolutely. And this isotope has a half-life of about 200 years. And because this stuff is soluble in water, it means it would seep into the ground and then be taken up by plants. And that would mean that sheep would then graze and pick this stuff up.
Because I remember there being stories of areas where sheep couldn't graze because it was still polluted by fallout from Chernobyl.
Precisely. And one of the questions is, where are these radioactive places? Now, there was a project a few years ago where they actually put GPS trackers on sheep and they released them into fields. And in the evening, they would go and check whether the sheep was hot or not. And if it was hot, they would then be able to trace where the sheep had traveled and identify the radioactive hotspot and be able to deal with it. Now, the crucial thing to remember is that the cesium that is used for atomic clocks and a host of other applications is completely stable. And it's a different isotope, of course, from what came out of the nuclear reactor.
And just so happens you've got some cesium here, haven't you?
Well, we've got some cesium. It's actually in the tin it came in when we bought it.
So you buy cesium in tins, do you?
You buy cesium in tins. And it's a little bit like opening a can of beer or something. It's here very carefully wrapped, and there's an important reason for this. Cesium is, the element itself, is extremely reactive.
So it comes in a gray blanket, which Andrea
it's
is
blanket,
now on.
Blanket, then inside there's some bubble
pink
wrap.
Bubble wrap.
And in the center is a beautiful glass ampoule, about 8 centimeters long, and inside it you can see.
Oh, wow.
That's gleaming, slightly yellowish. It's got a tiny golden sheen.
Golden
sheen.
Can I hold it? Is it?
Of course. Don't drop it.
Wow, that is very beautiful.
It's
so it's kind of like 3/4 full of what looks like a liquid's been poured into it, but it's gone hard.
And in fact, if we were to hold it long enough in our hands, it melts very, very low. And what we'll get is the liquid inside the ampoule. Now, it's extremely reactive with air. This is why it's in this sealed ampoule. And if, in fact, we were to drop this into water, then what it will do is immediately release hydrogen, and there will be a very loud bang because the hydrogen will ignite and explode.
So it's actually quite dangerous stuff.
The element itself is quite dangerous. But once, in fact, you've transformed it into compounds, such as the salts, then it's really very, very stable and only moderately poisonous.
Only moderately positive. How reassuring that is.
Well, the crucial thing when you ask yourself whether a metal, for example, is poisonous, is does it resemble in sort of shape and behavior other metals in the periodic table? And in this case, cesium can actually mimic potassium. So it's able to move through ion channels looking like potassium. And this will affect nervous function, that sort of thing. Now, there was an experiment in which cesium was fed to rats, and it turned out that it made the rats really rather ratty, irritable, hyperactive, and so on.
Listen, I've got enough issues with that already. Keep that well away from me. But listen, is there anything else apart from these wonderful light effects that you've shown me that cesium can be used for?
Well, I think the final areas where it's used is the fact that cesium and its compounds are very, very dense indeed. And so you can actually make, for example, cesium-containing brines. In other words, very, very concentrated cesium salt solutions. These are very dense, and they can actually be used in the sort of oil and gas industry, essentially to displace fluids deep underground.
Last week's program, we discovered that bromine is used again to help pump out oil. But there are kind of risks and health scares associated with bromine. So this, in a sense, is a kind of more eco-friendly way to recover your hydrocarbons?
Well, I think there have been attempts to find alternatives to bromide. And cesium formate is one possibility. But I suspect that every time you choose an element, if you actually start throwing it around willy-nilly into the environment, you will find problems.
Andrea Seller, thank you very much indeed.
You are listening to the latest episode of Elemental Economics from the Business Daily team. I am Justin Rowlatt.
And here at the National Physical Laboratories, they have another commercial application of cesium. Here, they actually sell time. And I'm back with Leon Lobo. And of course, you, as we heard earlier, are responsible for disseminating time. Now, where have you brought me?
So we're at the Timescales Laboratory at NPL, where the UK's time comes from.
Wow, so this is quite an interesting room. There's a big bank of computers. So this is actually where you keep the clocks?
That's correct. We've got some of the clocks here, some cesium clocks and some others as well.
So listen, Leon, I'm struggling to understand why anyone would need to measure time to the kind of accuracy that you're talking about. Why do we need such accurate measures of time?
So it's particularly important when you're operating at a frequency which requires that level of accuracy at the microsecond level. This is very, very similar to the Victorian railways, where time across Britain was not the same. Midday in Bristol was 11 minutes behind London, and all the railways were operating on London timetables, effectively, so people were missing trains.
Oh, so as soon as the railways expanded across Britain, suddenly you needed to coordinate, so railway timetables meant something if you were in Edinburgh or you were in Cardiff or
exactly.
You were in Bristol.
And that's where they unified the time.
Okay, and obviously an accuracy of minutes and seconds was fine for the Victorians, but what you're saying is the kind of technology we use now means we need to unify time around the world to the microsecond.
Absolutely, particularly in areas like the financial sector, where there are millions of trades occurring every second, suddenly that common clock, or the lack of the common clock at the microsecond, becomes very important.
Microsecond?
Yeah, it's a millionth of a second.
And if that's enough, is it? Because you can go further, you can go nano.
The capability is at the parts in 10 to the 16, femtoseconds.
Femtoseconds,
yeah.
So this is beyond nano and pico to femto.
That's right.
I've never even heard of femto.
So the systems that are required in commercial space are several orders of magnitude below that.
So you're happy with microsecond to six decimal places.
That's correct. Is critical for the likes of the financial sector because of the algorithmic side of trading.
Trading done by computers automatically.
Automatically, where strangely enough, at the microsecond level, there is no common clock.
Why does that matter?
It matters massively from the point of view of understanding what took place first, as well as developing and optimizing systems.
So, which is a very complicated way of saying if you don't measure time accurately, you might lose money.
Massive amounts.
Massive. Why so much money?
At the rate trading occurs these days, it's at many millions of trades per second. Over the past couple of years, there have been several instances where market data, for example, has been put out before it should have been done, and all the automatic systems trade on that information, and a huge amount of money changes hands when it shouldn't be happening.
It's not just financial markets, though, is it, that you sell into?
This is completely applicable to the telecom sector, for example, where you need mobile base station synchronization, the energy sector, where they use precise time for phase synchronization of power grids, particularly when renewables feed into the grid.
So you need to understand when to introduce different power stations to make sure that you can deliver the supply of electricity that's being demanded at the time.
But also the broadcast sector, where you need network synchronization. For example, for this, when you're sending this out, it's essential that the timing of all the transmitters are synchronized.
How much would you charge me to tell me the time?
If you get a checkbook, I'll write down a figure.
Although there is a clock just here, which can tell us. Can I turn the screen around?
Absolutely.
And just for the record, we're completing this interview at 2:56 and 6 seconds. And of course, the milliseconds are moving far too quickly for me to even begin to try and guess what they are. Thank you very much indeed, Leon Lobo of the National Physical Laboratories. No. But the creation of atomic clocks and this super accurate measurement of time has created a completely new and extraordinary issue for timekeepers around the world, as I discovered when I spoke to Felicitas Arias.
So how did the invention of the atomic clock affect measurement standards at the Bureau International de Poids et Mesures?
The Bureau International des Poids et Mesures, the international.
That was a bit
Bureau.
Better than me. Well done.
So it is the International Bureau for Weights and Measures, uh-huh. is responsible for keeping the uniformity of worldwide measurements.
So it's your job to get the most precise measurements possible of all the things that you weigh and you measure.
Yes. So one of the units is the second. And the second changed its definition several times.
Did it?
Yes, it did. It did. At the very beginning, the second was defined by the rotation of the Earth.
Uh-huh. Very sensible.
So 24 hours was what we call a day.
And then you divided it up into hours, minutes and seconds. And what happened next?
We realized that the Earth was not rotating uniformly. So that means one day is not always exactly 24 hours of equal seconds.
So let's be clear, that's because the Earth wobbles a little bit on its axis. The length of days varies,
change.
And therefore, in theory, a second varies. So once you decided the Earth wasn't accurate enough for you, Felicitas, what did you look to next?
So in 1956, Louis Essen built the first atomic clock. And in the middle of the 60s, there was a big discussion whether to refine the astronomical definition of the second based not on the rotation of the Earth, but on the orbit of the Earth around the Sun, or to go for a different definition that was based on an atomic transition of one special atom, cesium-133. So that is today the definition
right.
of the second.
Now, the fact that time was disassociated from the movement of the celestial bodies, what difference did that make in terms of measuring seconds? Because suddenly there were missing seconds, weren't there?
In a way, the atomic time scale was perfect for time metrology because it was a uniform time scale. But at that time, 1970, it was not adapted for those needing access to rotational time. So for celestial navigation on the sea, it was necessary to be synchronized with rotational time.
Right, which gave rise to a problem, didn't it?
It gave rise to a problem, but the solution was to study the rotation of the Earth and to decide whether it was necessary to make some synchronization, injecting a second.
Ah, so these are the famous leap seconds, are they?
This is the leap second.
And that reflects the fact that the new timescale, the cesium timescale, based on the atomic clock, is in a sense more accurate than the movement of these celestial bodies.
Yes, so Coordinated Universal Time, UTC, the time reference for the world, that's based on the atomic second.
Right.
But whenever necessary, a leap second can be inserted.
Felicitas, how often do you have to insert these leap seconds?
That's one of the problems. There are a lot of factors that provoke perturbations on the Earth's rotation.
So you're continuously looking for these perturbations, as you call them, of the motion of the Earth, and then quickly slipping an extra second to make things right again.
Right. During a long time, leap seconds came about every 2 years. Then we had 7 years without leap seconds.
7 years without a leap second?
Yes, and then they came back maybe every 2 years, 2 years and a half. But, you know, the Earth is slowing down in the long term.
Oh.
So maybe in the future, we will have to insert more than one leap second per year.
You're going to be busy.
We are going to be busy, but the clocks all over the world will going to be more busy than us.
Because they all have to adjust when you do it. So now there is this proposal, isn't there, to go over completely to atomic time and forget all this motion of the celestial bodies that you talk about so poetically.
Yes, the point is that the world changed. You have a cell phone.
I do.
There is a system allowing you to use your cell phone. You need to have a good position and you need to have a good time synchronization. And this marvelous synchronization is provided by satellites orbiting the Earth, GPS from US, GLONASS from the Russian Federation, we hope Galileo from the European Union, the Chinese system Beidou, will put in the sky hundreds of satellites. So those systems for navigating need very, very accurate time synchronization.
And the advantage, if you had atomic clocks, everybody would be synced to the same time. It would be much more predictable. They wouldn't have you every now and then putting in an extra second.
That's the point.
I mean, who does the leap seconds cause problems for? Because you've talked about GPS. There are issues elsewhere, aren't there, in the financial markets, leap
seconds? The issues are in all activities related to network transmission of information. The leap second is really, really a big problem. Because 1 second in the financial market can provoke a kind of earthquake. The point is that you may lose synchronization. Let's say for stock exchange, there is a machine in New York, a machine in Tokyo, a machine in Paris, linked to an atomic clock that provide a time signal.
To sort of calibrate.
Yes. So if you contact the server at the moment of the insertion of a leap second, you have 2 seconds with the same name. Your server can misinterpret this message and you can spend some time with a 1 second step in your time scale. There is also a very strong point with electrical power grids. They can lose synchronization and you can have, of course, a power problem all over a territory.
Isn't there a problem with some computer networks where they'll just shut down, maybe just for a second or two, but enough time to create an opportunity for kind of fraudsters, maybe a chink in their security armor, if you like?
Yes, that's an issue. In order to avoid these kind of perturbations, the method is to shut down the service during a few minutes before and after the leap second. So for many systems, airport control, it might be a security issue for sure.
Say we went over to atomic time. Would time become disconnected with the rising and the setting of the sun?
Yes, the offset will increase. And we can predict that in 1,000 years, we could be at 1 hour.
Well, that's quite a lot, shifting. Though, isn't it?
That's quite a lot. I mean, I don't plan to see that. However, we already live in most parts of the world very shifted from solar time. Because the Earth moves around the sun in an orbit that is elliptical.
Ah.
So you have a shift between mean solar time and the real sun that can amount 16 minutes. Then you say, I am in a time zone. A time zone is 1 hour of motion of the sun on the sky. So people living in different parts of a territory will see the sun in the sky at the top, not exactly at noon. So, for example, in France, you can have differences that amount up to 3 hours.
So essentially, we're saying that depending where you are, the sun is at a different point in the sky, despite what your watch says.
Yes.
Who's opposed to switching over to atomic time and why?
One of the countries is United Kingdom. UK still keeps the official time defined as GMT.
Greenwich Mean Time. One time was the basic measure of time around the world and everything related to time.
This was until 1948.
So we're just hanging on to this historic role we had in the early days of the definition of time.
You know which is the reason.
But you would have thought the UK, with its huge financial services sector, you would have thought they'd want a super accurate definition of time to encourage traders and stuff to come and locate here, wouldn't you?
That's a good point. There is also another point for the British administration. There is not really a strong evidence. Problems arise from leap second application. They say, okay, let's wait. We need more evidence.
That was Felicitas Arias of the International Bureau of Weights and Measures in Paris. And that decision about whether to abolish the leap second will be made in November next year at the World Radio Communications Conference, which is, appropriately enough, always held in the world capital of clockmaking in Geneva in Switzerland. Well, we've heard from a real time lady, the woman in charge of keeping time for the world. Now we've got a real time lord for you, Martin Rees. The Lord Rees of Ludlow is a cosmologist and astrophysicist. He is the current Astronomer Royal, a position created by Charles II when he established the Royal Observatory in Greenwich in 1675. The observatory was tasked with finding the so much desired longitude of places. As we've discovered, the solution then and now is accurate timekeeping. But what is the cesium clock and its mind-blowingly precise successors actually measuring?
Well, it measures time, which is, of course, one of the most crucial features of the universe. And the measurement of time has been an important part of science, I guess, right back to the Babylonians, who first worried about the calendar and the length of the day, etc. And precision measurements of time has been at the frontier of high tech all the way through history. One thinks of the wonderful clocks made in the 14th or 15th century and now the cesium clocks.
I mean, obviously, the idea of these super precise clocks is to provide a kind of absolute measure of time. But does such a thing actually exist?
Not absolutely, no. And one thing we've learned from Einstein is that the speed at which clocks move depends on where they are and on how they're moving. For instance, if you go on a spaceship and move away from the Earth at a good fraction of the speed of light and then come back again, you will find that far less time has elapsed on your clock than has elapsed by the folks who stayed at home. So it's possible in principle for you to travel to the edge of the universe and back in your own lifetime. But when you come back, you would find that the Earth had aged by billions of years. We don't need to worry about these effects normally because you need to move at nearly the speed of light or be in a much stronger gravitational force than we have on the Earth in order for these effects to be large. So we get by pretty well with the sort of science that goes back to Newton about time just ticking away at a steady rate for everyone. But in fact, when we think of measuring time very precisely, as we now do with cesium clocks, then the rate at which the clock ticks does depend on where it is. For instance, if a clock is up in space, it ticks at a different speed from on the ground. And incidentally, without making allowances for Einstein's relativity, the GPS system, crucial for sat-nav and many other purposes, wouldn't work because that requires very precise measurements of time.
Central to our experience of time is that time moves forward. Why does it move forward? I mean, does it necessarily move forward? Could we go back in time?
Well, of course, people sometimes say time is a fourth dimension. We have three dimensions of space, left and right, backwards and forwards, up and down. In those three dimensions, we can move either way. But time, sadly, we can't move back and correct our errors. There are, as you know, lots of science fiction stories. But you get all these famous paradoxes, like what happens if you kill your grandmother when she's in her cradle, and things like that. So most people suspect that time travel into the past is not possible.
Now, I don't properly understand this. You're the Astronomer Royal, so maybe you do. But in a sense, at the quantum level of a cesium atom's oscillation, time doesn't really have an obvious direction yet. Obviously, at the macroscopic level, the level at which we experience time, it clearly does.
Yes, this is a very fundamental paradox about the universe, which is that, as you say, at the microscopic level,
it is the same whether you go forwards or backwards. And if you take, for instance, a movie of something very simple, like billiard balls moving around, if you neglect friction, you couldn't tell which way they were going. But, of course, in practice, we know that we are in a universe where there is a very clear time's arrow. And this is because of the way the universe started off. I mean, a Big Bang started off very small, and it starts off very smooth, and the way structures develop as the universe expands sets a very definite direction of time. And we're very familiar of how the direction of time is imprinted on all macroscopic phenomena. For instance, if I knock a cup off the table and it breaks on the floor, you take a movie of that and play it backwards, you know that the backward movie never actually happens, despite the fact that on a microscopic level, the forward and backward movies will be the same.
Now, there are really interesting theories about the possibility that there are different branches that we go down in time. These are kind of multiverse theories, is that right?
Yes, well, there are two kinds of multiverse theories. The one you're thinking of is the idea that when we have a quantum uncertainty and we don't know which option's going to happen on the microworld, then, in fact, what happens is that the universe, as it were, divides. And both things happen, and we find ourselves in one part rather than the other. So this implies that there are huge numbers of universes. We find ourselves in one, but there would be some avatar of ours that took the other path.
Yeah, that's a very hard concept for a layman to understand. I mean, do you believe that's the way the universe is structured?
Well, certainly the effects that happen in the quantum world, the microscopic world of atoms, they are certainly real. The many worlds interpretation is just one interpretation of this. But I think the important point to make is that what we think of as common sense and what we can easily grasp is really the physics of the everyday world and the ordinary scales that we see, you know, things between a millimetre and a few miles across. And we shouldn't be too surprised in a way that when we talk about things happening on the scale of either a single atom or at the other extreme on the scale of the entire universe, then our everyday intuitions break down. There's no particular reason why we should have a natural intuition into phenomena that are on scales quite different from everyday experience.
So why is it then that you obviously find it much easier to understand these ideas than me?
Well, because I've spent years thinking about them. I think the point is that when we get away from the ordinary everyday scales of our experience, we shouldn't be too surprised that phenomena are a bit counterintuitive. Indeed, I'd turn the argument the other way around and say that it's rather remarkable that our brains, which haven't changed very much since our remote ancestors roamed the African savannas, have been able to make some sense of phenomena like the quantum world, the speed of light, and the cosmos. I think it's rather remarkable we've got that far.
That was Martin Rees, the cosmologist, astrophysicist and astronomer royal, reflecting on the nature of time. And if you're intrigued by cesium's role in the mysteries of time, you may want to listen to the other fascinating programmes in the Elemental Economics series. To save you time, we've collected them all together into a single website. You can find it at bbc.com/elements. That is bbc.com/elements. And make time to tune in next week when we tackle a real heavyweight of the periodic table. I bet you can guess what that is.